This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
We know humans are overrunning the natural world. We didn't know it was this bad. According to a new scientific study, since the 1990s, planet Earth has lost 10% of its wilderness. That bombshell work comes from a team led by Dr. James Watson. In Australia, he's an associate professor at the University of Queensland. Watson is also the director of the Science and Research Initiative at the Wildlife Conservation Society, and that's based in New York City. Plus, he leads or is part of a half dozen other global-scale initiatives on climate change and ecosystem science. He's published over 100 papers. Dr. James Watson, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex.
Why don't we start with the slippery term wilderness? How did you define that for this study?
Yeah, wilderness is a bit of a slippery term. We try to make it as simple as possible. We just mapped those areas on Earth that were not affected by large-scale infrastructure. That's things like mining or roads or industrial logging, as well as urbanisation, large-scale agriculture, and then joined those all together in a map and made that spatially consistent across Earth and looked at those areas that weren't affected by those activities. So to put it another way, we just looked at those areas on Earth that have still got either no populations of humans or very low populations of humans and where there was no visible evidence of large-scale modification.
I'm almost surprised that you could find any places like that.
Oh, look, the Earth is large. You know, there's many places that we know there's very low populations across the Earth. And we found that there's still around 25% that is largely unaffected by large-scale human activities. But what was scary, and as you alluded to at the start, is that we've lost a significant amount, 3 million square kilometres of those areas in just over 20 years. Now, that's an area twice the size of Alaska, or half the size of Australia, gone in 20 years. And that's quite alarming, considering that once you lose these areas, you never get them back. You can't restore a wilderness area. You can't offset it. Once they are degraded, they'll return to something else. And that's a real concern when you think about conservation of biodiversity, when you can think about climate change.
So where are the biggest areas of diminishing wilderness?
Look, the area that was most affected was the Amazon. We found 30% of the Amazon has been lost in the last 20 years, which is an alarming rate. And it's scary because it's been often talked about as a good news story. There's been some very progressive policies made by governments that contained the Amazon around stopping deforestation during that time period. But the satellites don't lie. What we show is that literally one-third of all wilderness areas in Amazon was lost in just over 20 years. Central African forests lost a lot as well. There's about 15% of those forests that were lost. But there was degradation everywhere. You know, like in Australia, we lost a lot of the northern savannas, which are the great tropical woodlands that occur across our north. They have been degraded considerably. In Southeast Asia, there's very little wilderness left, simply because of the amount of population pressure there, but even the spots that you would expect to see wilderness have been declining dramatically. Those areas in Borneo and in Burma and in Indonesia, you see some massive decline there as well.
And I noticed you looked at Siberia as well. Why?
Oh, look, it's anywhere that is not untouched. So, you know, all ecosystems are equal, you know, in terms of regardless of how many species they hold or how productive they are. They all are important. They've had long evolutionary histories, and they should be considered equal. So we look at every ecosystem on the terrestrial surface. And, you know, the boreal forests and the tundra are doing quite well when you've looked at the pressures that we looked at. Sadly, though, the one pressure we couldn't map was climate change, you know, and if you put that into the equation, I'm sure that those high-latitude ecosystems and those high-mountain ecosystems would be very affected.
Okay, so beyond the biology, you have expertise in climate change. Is there a direct relationship between a changing climate and loss of wilderness?
Look, there's definitely evidence, a significant evidence, of climate change impacting ecological processes around the world. You know, and what that we're seeing is that those ecological processes are being altered, and that is therefore affecting the very functioning of some of these intact ecosystems. So where I'm from in Australia, what we see time and time again is a drying system, you know, because of global warming, means that there's far more fire-prone activity occurring, you know, across ecosystems that rarely experience fire. So in Tasmania, the island in the southern part of the continent of Australia, and it's, you know, considered one of the most beautiful areas on Earth, areas of wilderness there have burnt for the first time in its evolutionary history, and they've burnt so considerably that they'll never come back. And we're not talking small areas, we're talking thousands and thousands of square kilometres of area was lost because of a fire event that occurred because it was so dry that when a match was lit, it actually burnt a system that should be moist and be able to buffer a fire, and we've lost that system. So climate change is having a real impact, and it's having varying impacts across a lot of ecosystems around the world.
Can we take the reverse position and say the decline of wilderness makes climate change worse, operating like a positive feedback?
It's 100% of positive feedback. What we show is that some of these ecosystems store huge amounts of carbon. The boreal forest in North America contains some astronomical amount of soil carbon and carbon in the woody debris. Now, when you erode those systems or when you degrade them, what is shown is that at least 50% of the carbon that was in that system is released back in the atmosphere. So you're seeing a massive land use impact on climate change. And our fear is this has been underreported at the moment. What we know is that nations report back on their land use as part of their agreements to the United Nations Framework for Climate Change, and they don't consistently do that. So we believe that a lot of ecosystem degradation isn't really caught up in the carbon accounts that nations report, and therefore we're underestimating the actual real impact to the atmosphere when it comes to carbon concentrations. Wilderness areas in particular, because they're so carbon dense, especially these boreal forests and these tropical rainforests, when they degrade, a lot of carbon is released. And I just think that it's underreported, and as you say, a massive positive feedback loop when it comes to climate change.
Now, you mentioned satellites. How did your team actually pick up a picture of what's happening with wilderness? What's the technique behind this?
So we used a number of techniques to try and understand our human pressure on Earth. You know, we used satellite images, and that was able to detect things like night lights, like urbanisation, like large-scale agricultural change. But we combined that with mapping activities that looked at roads, looked at population densities, looked at pasture lands. So we were able to use bottom-up techniques and also top-down techniques that have come from satellites to really come to this spatially consistent map of where we thought pressure was on Earth. Now, this process of actually joining all this data together is incredibly complicated, and it's one of the reasons why we don't often get these kind of updated human footprint maps, is because it's really technically very hard. But when you get a product like this, you can actually start assessing things over time. How has the human footprint changed across space and time? And that's the power of our research. Obviously, as data gets better, as satellite data gets better, road data gets better, human population data gets better, we'd like it to feed into this and make it iterative so the maps get better and better. So we've decided to make all our data open access, and that we've got a platform that people can look at and actually add data to, so that we can actually get a better picture over time as the human pressure changes across Earth.
I guess eventually that'll be available in real time to all of us. We can really see what's happening on our planet.
Look, I think what would be exciting is that, you know, every time we watch the news, we look at the stock exchange working in real time. You know, every time you watch the news, you see scores of your favourite sports teams every weekend, you know, buzzing across the bottom of the television set. What I'd love to happen is that an indicator like this is actually reported on nightly thing just right next to the weather or right next to the stock exchange, saying, and this is how the human environment's going, and this is how climate change is going, so that we can actually have real-time updates on what's going on and make it just a common conversation about our state of play in the world.
You know, we talked about climate as a driver of wilderness loss, but I think most of us picture it as economic exploitation, whether it's multinational corporations or just poor people desperate for an income or a place to grow food. How do you assess that driver?
In terms of economic growth?
Yeah, I mean, is that the primary cause of loss of wilderness, or is it other things?
Look, there's two fundamental drivers, I think, and to be really frank, the first is population growth. Like, our population is, you know, getting out of control in some cases, and it's not going to calm down for a while yet. You know, a lot of people predict that the world's population is probably going to get stabilized at about 12 billion people. It's rapid population growth that is, and the consumption of goods by humans is causing a lot of environmental harm. That is one factor that, you know, that is a serious driver of every problem we face on Earth, if you look at it. The second driver, of course, is nations really trying to achieve this standard of economic sustained growth, and they mark their how they're doing in the world in terms of how well our economies are growing. Now, it's unsustainable to have economic growth, at high rates all the time. That is just, any economist worth their salt will say it's actually an impossible thing to keep on going. But as you drive economic growth and you're driving consumption, and on top of this population growth, it's one of the reasons why, the natural resources of the world are being massively depleted.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Dr. James Watson. He's with the University of Queensland in Australia and the Wildlife Conservation Society. He's brought out an important piece of science on wilderness with the title, Catastrophic Declines in Wilderness Areas Undermine Global Environmental Targets. I want to ask you, is there a tipping point or a biominimum when we've lost too much wilderness to continue evolution on this planet, or would we even know if we crossed such a threshold?
Well, I think that's an excellent question. I think everyone asks me, when I do media or when I, even in scientific workshops and conferences, how much does nature need? What is, it's a bare minimum. And the only thing I can say to, as a fair response is that we know what nature needs. Nature needs 100%. That's how evolution worked. Nature sustained itself and actually underwent unbelievable ecological and evolutionary processes to see, to come up with the systems that we see around us today because they had 100%. Now we've degraded the Earth considerably over the last 300 or so years since the Industrial Revolution. And we know that almost every ecosystem on Earth is now being massively degraded to much smaller extents. Now, I think some biomes still have enough nature in them that is functioning that to sustain something that what we used to have before humans dominated the Earth. Whether it's enough to actually sustain whole wide-scale evolutionary processes, it's hard to tell. But, some systems like the tundra, and the boreal forests in the northern latitudes, they are still fairly large and fairly extensive. But the other side of the coin is we know that certain ecosystems have been completely smashed. Mediterranean ecosystems, lowland rainforest ecosystems, mangrove ecosystems, seagrass ecosystems. We know that they have been so dramatically modified. We're talking about 99% modification here. That the chances of those systems being able to go through natural evolutionary processes that that would have happened before humans touched them is not going to happen. That's absolutely unrealistic. Now, there will be evolution in all these systems. Evolution is a continual process, and that and when you have major disruptions such as an asteroid strike or a major natural climate change event, you do see disruptions, which actually causes great numbers of speciation. It's actually a big circuit breaker when you think about evolution. The difference, though, between what happens naturally over geologic timescales and what we're seeing on the Earth now is that we're giving nature a good series of stresses at the same time, which will definitely impede that ability to bounce back, nature's ability to undergo evolution. So when you clear most of the habitat and then you force a massive climate change event on top of species, their resilience is so much reduced that the chances of a evolutionary response in a short time scale is going to be unlikely across many of these systems.
Now, one thing that worries me a little bit about your study is that we're taking the 1990s as a starting point because that's when reliable satellite mapping becomes available, I presume. But, of course, we've talked with biologists who say Earth lost important wilderness long before that. Is there a reliable benchmark for the state of the wild, and are we in danger of everybody comparing things to the beginning of satellites when we should be taking a broader time scale?
Oh, yeah, look, I think that's a fair criticism, but, just maybe to push back a little bit, we know what the benchmark was. Before humans, it was 100%. So, in 1993, we had about 28% of the world that was wilderness, and now in 2016, there was 25%. of the world is wilderness. So we are going from the benchmark of 100% to, you know, down to 25 and below. So I think, you know, you're right that we shouldn't just say that 1993 is when it all started. I think the reality and what we're trying to make the case in the science is that we started from a very, very bad position already and it got worse. And what is scary about these findings is that there's diminishing areas left. You know, the green spaces on Earth are retracting to the cold places of the Earth and the dry places of the Earth, the deserts and the, you know, and the Arctic and the Antarctic and the high mountains. That's where our wilderness is retracting to. But it's still retracting. It's not slowing down. Even if you've got less and less area available, we're not seeing a slowing down. So our fingerprint, our footprint is actually still expanding despite the fact that you get so much retreated to areas that are not very hospitable to humans. That's a scary finding. And it begs the question, well, when will it stop? Now, how much wilderness will be there in 50 years' time? Where will it be located? And our findings show that, you know, there might be not much left, which is incredibly sad for our children and their children and also for the planet.
So what do you think? Can a human civilization continue on a planet without wilderness?
Of course it can. You know, humans are incredibly technically efficient and able to, you know, to live in... That's the thing about humans. They're able to live anywhere under almost any circumstance. They are incredible at adapting to change. But whether it's going to be a nice place to live, whether, you know, it begs the better question. You know, I think that humans are causing so much damage to Earth right now. I mean, we're going to be losing considerable number of our ecosystems and the species that sustain them. And I'm talking about 50 to 80% of these species around us. We won't be there in 50 to 100 years' time. Now, will humans still be here? I'm betting they will. You know, I think unless there's a catastrophic event like a world war or a nuclear strike, we'll be around. But what kind of life will it be without any coral reefs? What kind of life will it be, you know, 5 degrees warmer, daily average temperature? What kind of life will it be, you know, when there will be no green spaces to go walk in and actually just listen to bird sound and listen and see wild animals doing incredible things? I think it's going to be a very sad day that when we have to rely on David Attenborough and just look at the television to get all that kind of thrill around seeing nature and really reflect that, you know, those species and those places just don't exist anymore.
Well, that's the finale in the sci-fi movie Soylent Green. When people were passing on, they got to see films of what nature was like and a terrible state. So let's move from that. Is there any hope we can turn this destruction around, James Watson? And if so, how?
Look, I think definitely. I think there's definite hope. I think it's, you know, and it starts with leadership. You know, it starts with leadership at national scales, which can then change international way of thinking about things. So there are a lot of nations that contain large-scale wilderness areas that are developed, that are democratically elected, and that with the right push and the right leadership can save them. Now, Australia is one of them. The US is another. Canada is another. Brazil is another. These countries, if they just combine their leadership and it's gone, you know what? These last intact places, which are so important as reference points for what nature looks like without humans being there, are very, very important. And we are going to proactively stop their degradation by stopping bad activities that are aimed at economic growth but are bad for the environment in them. That we can easily sustain that kind of law. Those nations can actually then work together, actually say, look, we've saved our wildernesses, and then set up some mechanisms to allow those developing nations that need to utilise their natural resources to actually set up some financial mechanisms to reward them for keeping their intact systems intact and trying to develop through other means. Now, I think that is very doable. We still have a lot of large intact places left, but the trick is to act quickly. And as I say, act as a global community with leadership from those developed nations who are willing to actually offset some of their financial growth to ensure that their natural systems are still in place in the future. So I think there is hope. I think, you know, the truth is, I think with climate change in particular now really resonating around a lot of people, that this action is going to be coming soon. You know, I think that, you know, I think people are not going to tolerate a world of 2 degrees, let alone 5 degrees. What I hope is that other environmental outcomes will come about if we all act together. And one of those environmental outcomes, I think, should be preserving the last intact ecosystems on Earth as part of the, you know, the outcome that we want Earth to have as we go through these kind of major dilemma points that we're facing right now.
But I have to be frank, I didn't hear that dialogue coming out of the Paris Climate Agreement talking about wilderness preservation.
So this is the reason why we wrote this paper. That's exactly because that was largely missing. And that doesn't mean that that conversation's over forever. It means that we've got to actually raise awareness around the issue and make sure it actually enters into the next bit of dialogue. You know, so one of the things that we hope from writing this paper is just to make the point to policymakers, to leaders, saying you've forgotten something. You've forgotten something quite substantial, and that is these ecosystems, these large intact ecosystems, play a substantial role in combating climate change, in combating species extinction. They're incredibly important for hundreds of millions of the most marginalised people on the Earth. Now let's put them into the treaty and really account for them and set targets around them. Yeah, so we raised the issue, and we're now hoping to engage with policymakers to ensure that that's in the next text around the UNFCCC, the Convention for Biological Diversity, and other conventions such as the Sustainable Development Goals.
Now, I have to admit, I get a little confused about some of the wilderness protection groups. Could you tell us just briefly, what is the Wildlife Conservation Society and what's your role there?
So the Wildlife Conservation Society is, you know, one of the largest conservation non-government organisations in the world. You know, it works in around 60 countries, in around 75 landscapes and seascapes. And it has a very clear vision of saving wild species and wild places. So it really does, at its core, really have this idea of thinking through that intact ecosystems are important and that maintaining those species that need them. So that's elephant species, rhinoceros species, tigers, lions, leopards. Those species need these large spaces. So trying to keep these kind of faunal assemblages intact in these systems. And as I say, we work in a lot of countries. Now, my role in that group, in the organisation, is to direct the science and research initiative. So this is to try and do cross-cutting science that influences global policy, but at the same time shares lessons across landscapes and seascapes. So I spend a lot of time travelling around the world talking with country directors and landscape directors about what challenges they face and what are the best types of science we can do to solve the challenges that, you know, that they're actually experiencing. And if there's lessons that can be learnt from other parts of the world, can actually work in their landscapes and seascapes.
Have you had that conversation in China of your advising what they can do to preserve what they've got left?
Oh, look, so WHS has a strong China office. I've not been there. My focus has been a lot in Africa and Asia and Latin America to some degree. What we do in China is work a lot on policy around on ivory trade and such like. So I haven't actually been there. I mean, one landscape we do have in China, which is amazing, is in Tibet. So, you know, it's one of the largest intact systems on the planet in the highlands of Tibet. And we've been working with local and federal governments there to try and keep that system in place. And from all reports, I've never been there, but all reports, it's been going fantastically well. That there's been fantastic efforts done by the government and by the local community to actually keep these systems in place.
Well, I don't want to keep you too long, but just out of curiosity, what is the Green Fire Science Group?
So that's my lab at the University of Queensland. So I have a research lab of 10 PhD students and 4 postdoctoral researchers. They are we're really focusing on applied research. I don't want to be a research lab that actually just writes papers for the sake of writing papers. So all my students are dedicated to ensuring their science actually is applied at either the local scale or the global scale. And so right now I have a PhD student in Indonesia working with the WCS program there. I have another program in Mozambique working with the local government there doing land use planning. Another student's actually supporting the Cambodia government. So the Green Fire Science Group is to try, you know, to get researchers and practitioners joined together focused on applied conservation science that can get to outcomes. So if your listeners are interested, just go Google greenfirescience.com and have a look at the website. And please send me an email. I'd love to hear their thoughts.
Well, I'll be putting some links to the science and the groups we've discussed in my Radio EcoShock show blog at ecoshock.info. From Australia, we've been talking with Dr. James Watson. I think he's an important sort of hybrid scientist who bridges not just climate change, but the relationships between climate and the natural world, or at least what's left of the wilderness. And that's what his new paper is about. James Watson, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks, Alex.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.